our sharing of the last coup could never last. The beasts must clash, and one will establish final dominance. Hawksung murmurs a prayer to his ancestors that he will come out of this maelstrom alive. Laughing Chan stands.
I guess we'll have to earn this bodyguard money after all.
Hawksung nods seriously. It will not be pretty. Not for anyone who is not prepared. Pak Eng begins pumping his spring gun.
It reminds me of Penang.
Not this time, Hawksung says. This time we are ready. He waves to them. Come. It's time we saw to whatever else we can. A banging on the door makes them all straighten.
Hawksung! Hawksung!
A hysterical voice, more pounding from outside.
It's Lao Gu.
Hawksung pulls open the door and Lao Gu stumbles in.
They've taken Mr. Leek! The foreign devil and all his friends!
Hawksung stares at the rickshaw man.
The white shirts are moving against him?
No! The trade ministry! I saw Akarat himself do the deed!
Hawksung frowns.
It makes no sense.
Lao Gu shoves a flyer into his hands.
It's the wind-up! The one that he kept bringing to his flat! She's the one that killed the Somdet Chao Phraya!
Hawksung reads quickly, nods to himself.
You're sure about this wind-up creature? Our foreign devil was working with an assassin?
I only know what it says on the whisper sheet, but that's the Ichikichi for sure, from the way it describes her.
He brought her from Plunchit many times.
Let her sleep there even.
Is it a problem?
Laughing Chan asks.
No.
Hawksung shakes his head, allows himself a smile. He goes and digs a ring of keys out from under his mattress.
An opportunity. A better one than I expected.
He turns to them all.
We won't be hiding here after all.
No?
Hawksung grins.
There's one last place we must go before we depart the city. One last thing to collect. Something from my old offices. Gather up the weapons.
To his credit, Laughing Chan does not question. Simply nods and holsters his pistols, slings a machete across his back. The rest do the same. Together they file out through the door. Hawksung closes it behind him. Hawksung jogs down the alley after his people, the keys to the factory jingling in his hand. For the first time in a long time, fate moves in his favor. Now all he needs is a little luck and a little more time. Up ahead, people are shouting about white shirts and the death of their queen's protector, angry voices ready for a riot. The storm is brewing. The battle pieces are being aligned. A little girl hurries past, pressing whisper sheets into each of their hands before dashing on. The political parties are already at work. Soon the godfather of the slum will have his own people down in the alleys inciting violence. Hawksung and his men make their way out of the squeezeways and pour out into the street. Nothing is moving. Even the freelance rickshaw men have gone to ground. A group of shopkeepers huddle around a hand crank radio. Hawksung waves at his men to wait, goes over to the listeners.
What news?
A woman looks up.
National radio says the protector...
Yes, I know that. What else does it say?
Minister Akarat has denounced General Pracha.
It's happening even faster than he expected. Hawksung straightens and calls to Laughing Chan and the others.
Come on. We're going to run out of time if we don't hurry.
As he calls to them, a huge truck comes around the corner, engine revving. It is astonishingly noisy. Exhaust trails behind it like an illegal dung fire. Dozens of hard-faced troops stare out from the back as it roars by. Hawksung and his men duck back into the alley, coughing. Laughing Chan peers out, following the truck's progress.
It's running on coal diesel,
he says wonderingly.
It's the army.
Hak-sung wonders if it is December 12 loyalists, some component of the Northeastern generals coming to aid General Pracha and retake the National Radio Tower. Or perhaps they are Akarat's allies, rushing to secure the sea locks or the docks or the anchor pads. Or perhaps they are simply opportunists, getting ready to take advantage of the coming chaos. Hak-sung watches as they disappear around a corner. Harbingers of the storm, regardless. The last pedestrians are disappearing into their homes. Shopkeepers are barring their storefronts from within. The clank and rattle of locks fills the streets. The city knows what is going to happen. Memories peck and swirl at Hak-sung. Alleys running thick with blood. The scent of green bamboo smoking and burning. He reaches for the reassurance of a spring gun and machete. The city may be a jungle full of tigers, but this time he is not some little deer running from Malaya. At last he has learned. It is possible to prepare for chaos. He motions to his men.
Come. This is our time.
Chapter 35.
It was not Pracha. He's not involved in this.
Kanya shouts into the crank phone. But she might as well be raving through the bars of a jail cell for all the impact it makes. Narong hardly seems to be listening. The line crackles with jumbled voices and the hum of machinery. And Narong, apparently speaking to someone nearby, his words unintelligible. Suddenly, Narong's voice crackles loud, blotting out the background sounds.
I'm sorry. We have our own information.
Kanya scowls at the whisper sheets on her desk, the ones that Pai brought in with a grim smile. Some speak of the fallen son of Chao Phraya, others of General Pracha. They all talk of the assassin wind-up girl. Fast copies of Sawat di Krung Tep are already pouring into the city. Kanya scans the words. It's full of impassioned complaints against the white shirts who shut down harbors and anchor pads but cannot protect the Somde Chao Phraya from a single invasive.
These whisper sheets are yours then, she asks.
Narong's silence is answer enough.
Why did you even ask me to investigate?
She can't keep the bitterness from her voice.
You are already moving.
Narong's cold voice crackles on the line.
It's not your place to question.
His tone brings her up short.
Did Akarat do it?
She whispers fearfully.
Was he the one responsible? Pracha says that Akarat was involved somehow. Did he do it?
Another pause. Is it a thoughtful one? She can't tell. Finally, Narong says,
No.
I swear this. We are not the ones responsible.
So you guess it must be Pracha, then?
She shuffles through the licenses and permits on her desk.
I'm telling you, he is not the one. I have all the wind-up's records here. Pracha himself wanted me to investigate, to find every trace of her. I have her arrival papers with the Mishimoto people. I have disposal papers. I have visas, everything.
Who signed the disposal papers?
She fights her frustration.
I can't read the signature. I need more time to cross-reference who was on duty around that time.
And by the time you do, they will inevitably be dead.
Then why did Pracha set me to the task of finding this information? It doesn't make sense. I talked to the officers who took the bribes at that bar. They were nothing but silly boys making a little extra money.
He's clever, then. He's covered his tracks.
Why do you hate Pracha so much?
Why do you love him? Did he not order your village razed?
Not from malice.
No.
Did he not sell the fish farming permits to another village the next season? Sell them and line his pockets with the profits? She falls silent. Narang moderates his tone. I'm sorry, Kanya. There's nothing we can do. We are certain of his crime. We have authorization from the palace to resolve this.
With riots?
She shoves the whisper sheets off her desk.
With a burning of the city? Please. I can't stop this. It's not necessary. I can find the proof that we need. I can prove that the wind-up is not Pracha's. I can prove it.
You're too close to this. Your loyalties are divided. I'm loyal to our queen. Just give me a chance to stop this madness. Another pause. I can give you 3 hours. If you have nothing by sunset, I can do nothing more.
But you'll wait until then?
She can almost hear the smile on the other end of the line. I will. And then the line is closed, and she is alone in her office. Jaidi settles himself on her desk.
I'm curious. How will you prove Pracha's innocence? It's obvious that he's the one who placed her.
Why can't you leave me alone? Kanya asks. Jaidi smiles.
Because it's Sanook. Very fun to watch you flail around and try to run for two masters.
He pauses, studying her. Why do you care what happens to General Pracha? He's not your real patron. Kanya looks at him with hatred. She waves at the whisper sheet strewn about her office.
It's just like it was 5 years ago. With Pracha and Prime Minister Surawang, with the December 12 gatherings.
Jaidi studies the whisper sheets.
Akarat moving against us this time, though. So it's not entirely the same.
Outside the window of her office, a megadont bellows. Jaidi smiles.
You hear that? We're arming. There's no way you can keep these two old bulls from clashing.
I don't know why you would even try. Pracha and Akarat have been bellowing and snorting at each other for years.
It's time we had a good fight.
This isn't Muay Thai, Jaidi.
No, you're right about that.
For a moment, his smile turns sad. Kanya stares at the whisper sheets, the collected paperwork on the wind-up's import. The wind-up is missing, but still, it came from the Japanese. Kanya studies the notes. She was brought across on a dirigible flight from Japan, an executive assistant,
and a killer.
Jaidi interjects.
Shut up, I'm thinking.
A Japanese wind-up. An abandoned bit of the island nation. Kanya stands abruptly, grabs her spring gun and shoves it into her holster as she gathers papers.
Where are you going?
Jaidi asks. She favors him with a thin smile. If I told you, that would take away the Sanook.
Jaidi's pea grins. Now you're getting to the spirit of things.
Chapter 36. The crowd around Emiko grows. People jostle her. There's nowhere to run. She's in the open, waiting to be discovered. Her first urge is to slash her way free, to fight for survival, even though there is no hope of escaping the crowd before she overheats.
I will not die like an animal. I will fight them. They will bleed.
She forces down the increasing panic, tries to think. More people squeeze around her, trying to get close to the posted sheet. She is trapped among them, but no one has noticed her yet. As long as she doesn't move. The press of the crowd is almost an advantage. She can barely shake, let alone display the stutter-stop motions that would betray her.
Slowly, carefully.
Emiko allows herself to lean against the people, to push slowly through them, head down, pretending to be a woman sobbing, shaking with grief at a blow against the palace. She stares at her feet, finding her way through the crowd, pressing carefully through until she reaches the outer edge. People huddle in groups, crying, sitting on the ground, staring around the street, stunned. Emiko feels a certain pity for them. Remembers watching Gendo-sama board his dirigible after he told her that he had done her a kindness, even as he abandoned her to the streets of Prungtep.
Focus,
she tells herself angrily. She needs to get away. Needs to reach the alley where people will not notice her. Wait for darkness.
Your description is everywhere. On methane posts, on the street, being trampled by the crowds. You have nowhere to go.
She stifles the thought. The alley is enough. The alley first. Then a new plan. She keeps her eyes on the ground. Clutches herself and mimes at sobbing. Shuffles for the alley. Slowly. Slowly.
You! Get over here!
Emiko freezes. Forces herself to look up slowly. A man beckons her, angry. She starts to speak, to protest, but someone behind her speaks instead.
You have something to say to me, Hiya?
A young man pushes past her, wearing a yellow headband and carrying a fistful of leaflets.
What's that you've got there, boy?
Others begin to drift over to watch the argument. The two start shouting at one another, posturing as they each try to establish dominance. Others start to take sides, to shout encouragement. Emboldened, the older slaps the younger and tries to tear off his yellow headband.
You're not for the queen! You're a traitor!
He strips the flyers from the young man's hand and throws them onto the ground, stamps on them.
Get out of here! Take Hiya Pracha's lies with you!
As leaflets blow through the crowd, Emiko catches a glimpse of Akarat's face, drawn in caricature, smiling as he tries to eat the grand palace. The younger one scrambles after his leaflets.
They're not lies! Akarat seeks to tear down the queen, it's obvious!
People in the crowd jeer at him, but others shout encouragement. The boy turns away from the man, speaks to the crowd.
Akarat is hungry for power. He always wants...
The man kicks him in the ass. The boy whirls, enraged, and attacks. Emiko sucks in her breath. The boy is a fighter. Muay Thai for certain. His elbow smashes into the man's head. The man collapses. The boy stands over him, screaming epithets. But his voice is drowned out by the crowd shouting, and then others surge forward, enveloping him in a clot of fists. His screams fill the street. Emiko turns and slips through the growing fight, no longer careful of her movements. People jostle her, rushing to aid or defend, and she shoves through as quickly as she can. In this moment, she is nothing to any of these people. She stumbles out of the riot and into the alley's shadows. The fight is spreading down the street. Emiko hunts for garbage to cover herself. Behind her, glass shatters. Someone is screaming. She huddles beside a shattered weatherall crate, pulling refuse around her. Durian rinds, the ripped hemp of a basket, discarded banana leaves, anything to give her cover. She freezes and hunkers low as rioters pelt down the alley, shouting. Everywhere she looks, she sees faces twisted with rage. Chapter 37 The main compounds of Mishimoto and Company lie on the far side of the water in Tonburi. The boat makes its way into a klong, Kanya's hand careful on the tiller. Even here, outside of Bangkok proper, whisper sheets complain of Pracha and the wind-up killer.
Do you think it's a good idea to come alone?
Jaidi asks. I've got you. It's enough company for anyone.
I'm not so great at Muay Thai in this state.
Pity.
The company's gates and jetties rise over the waves. The late afternoon sun scalds down on them. A water merchant paddles close, but even though Kanya is hungry, she does not dare waste even a moment. Already, the sun seems to be crashing out of the sky. Her boat thumps against the pier, and she whips its bow rope around a cleat.
I don't think they'll let you in,
Jaidi says. Kanya doesn't bother answering. It's odd that he has remained with her all the way across the water. The pattern of his pee was to take interest in her for a short time, and then to drift off to other things and other people. Perhaps he visited his children, made apologies to Chaya's mother. But now he is with her all the time. Jaidi says, they won't be impressed with that white uniform either. They've got too much influence with the trade ministry and the police.
Kanya doesn't answer, but sure enough, a Tonburi detachment of a police patrol guards the main gates of the compound. All around, the sea and klongs lap. The Japanese are forward-looking and have built themselves entirely on the water, on floating bamboo rafts that are said to lie nearly 50 feet thick, creating a compound nearly impervious to the floods and tides of the Chao Phraya River.
I need to speak with Mr. Yashimoto.
He is not available.
It concerns property of his that was damaged during the unfortunate raids on the airfields.
Paperwork for reparations.
The guard smiles and certainly ducks inside. Jaidi snickers.
Clever.
Kanya makes a face at him. At least you have some use.
Even if I'm dead.
A moment later, they are being led into the halls of the compound. It is not a long walk. High walls obscure all evidence of manufacturing activity. The Megadon Union complains that no work could be accomplished without a power source, and yet the Japanese neither import their own Megadons nor hire the Union. It reeks of illegal technology. And yet, the Japanese have provided a great deal of technical assistance to the kingdom. In return for Thai seed stock advances, the Japanese provide the best of their sailing technologies. And so everyone is exquisitely careful not to ask too many questions about how a ship's hull is built and if the development process is entirely legal. A door opens. A pretty girl smiles and bows. Kanya nearly draws her spring gun. The creature before her is a wind-up. The girl doesn't seem to notice Kanya's unease, though. Simply motions in her stutter-stop way for her to enter. Inside, the room is carefully decorated with tatami mats and sumi-e paintings. A man, Kanya assumes is Mr. Yashimoto, kneels, painting. The wind-up leads Kanya to a seat. Jaidi admires the art on the walls.
He painted it all, you know.
How would you know?
I came to see if they really have 10 hands in their factory, right after I died.
And do they?
Jaidi shrugs. Go look for yourself.
Mr. Yashimoto dips his brush, and in an exquisitely swift motion completes the painting. He rises and bows to Kanya. He begins speaking in Japanese. The wind-up girl's own voice follows a second later, with a translation into Thai.
I am honored by your visit.
He is silent for a moment, and the wind-up girl falls silent as well. She is very pretty, Kanya supposes, in a strange, porcelain way. Her cropped jacket is open at the collar, revealing the hollow of her throat, and her pale skirt molds fetchingly around her hips. She would be beautiful, if she were not so perverse.
You know why I'm here?
He nods shortly.
We have heard rumors of an unfortunate incident and have seen our country discussed in your papers and whisper sheets.
He looks at her significantly.
Many voices are being raised against us. Most unfair and inaccurate observations.
Kanya nods.
We have questions. I wish to assure you that we are a friend of the Tai. From times long ago, when we cooperated in the Great War, to now, we have always been a friend of the Tai. I want to know how, Yashimoto interrupts again.
Tea, he offers. Kanya forces herself to remain polite.
You're very kind.
Yashimoto motions to the wind-up girl and she stands and leaves the room. Unconsciously, Kanya relaxes. The creature is unsettling, and yet, now that she is gone, silence stretches between them as they wait for the translator to return.
Kanya feels seconds ticking away, minutes being lost, time moving.
Storm clouds gathering, and here she sits, waiting for tea. The wind-up girl returns, kneels beside them at the low table.
Kanya forces herself not to speak, not to interrupt the girl's precise whisking and steeping of the tea, but it is an effort.
The wind-up girl pours, and as Kanya watches the creature's strange movements, she thinks she sees a little of what the Japanese desired from their engineered servants. The girl is perfect, precise as clockwork, and contextualized by the tea ceremony. All her motions take on a ritual grace.
The wind-up carefully does not observe Kanya in return, does not say anything about her being a white shirt.
Does not observe that, in another context, Kanya would happily mulch her. She ignores Kanya's environment ministry uniform entirely, exquisitely polite.
Yashimoto waits for Kanya to sip her tea, then sips himself.
Sets his tea deliberately on the table.
Our countries have been friends always, he says, ever since our emperor made a gift of tilapia to the kingdom in the time of your great scientist, King Bumibol's time. We have always been steadfast.
He looks at her significantly.
I hope that we can help you in this matter, but I wish to emphasize that we are friends of your country.
Tell me about wind-ups, Kanya says.
Yashimoto nods.
What do you wish to know?
He smiles, motions at the girl kneeling beside them.
This one you can see for yourself.
Kanya keeps her expression impassive. It is difficult. The creature beside her is beautiful. Her skin is sleek, her movements surprisingly elegant, and she makes Kanya's skin crawl.
Tell me why you have them.
Yashimoto shrugs.
We are an old nation. Our young are few. Good girls like Hiroko fill the gap. We are not the same as the Tai. We have calories, but no one to provide the labor. We need personal assistants, workers.
Kanya carefully makes no show of disgust.
Yes, you Japanese are very different, and except for your country, we have never granted this sort of niche.
Crime, Jaidi supplies.
Exemption.
She finishes.
No one else is allowed to bring in creatures like this one.
She nods unwillingly at the translator, trying to hide the disgust in her voice.
No other country, no other factory.
We are aware of the privilege,
and yet you abuse it by bringing a military wind-up.
Hiroko's words cut her off, even as Kanya continues to speak.
Hiroko instead picks up the vehement response from her owner.
No, this is impossible. We have no contact with such technology. None.
Yashimoto's face is flushed, and Kanya wonders at his sudden anger. What sort of cultural insult has she unwittingly delivered? The wind-up girl continues her translation, no trace of emotion on her own face, as she speaks with her owner's voice.
We work with new Japanese like Hiroko. She is loyal, thoughtful, and skilled, and a necessary tool. She is as necessary as a hoe for a farmer, or a sword for a samurai.
Strange that you mention a sword.
Hiroko is no military creature. We do not have such technology.
Kanya reaches into her pocket and slaps down the picture of the wind-up killer.
And yet one of yours, imported by you, registered to your staff, has now assassinated the Somdet Chao Phraya and 8 others and disappeared into thin air as if she is some raging pea. But you sit before me and tell me that it is impossible for a military wind-up to be here.
Her voice rises to a shout, and the wind-up girl's translation finishes at a similar intensity. Yashimoto's face stills. He takes the picture and studies it.
We will have to check our records.
He nods to Hiroko. She takes the photo and disappears out the door. Kanya watches Yashimoto for traces of anxiety or nervousness, but there are none. Irritation she sees, but no fear. She regrets that she cannot speak directly with the man. Listening to her words echo into Japanese, Kanya wonders what surprise is lost when the wind-up girl delivers them. What preparation Hiroko provides for his shock. They wait. He silently offers more tea. She refuses. He does not drink any more himself. The tension in the room is so thick that Kanya half expects the man to leap to his feet and cut her down with the ancient sword that adorns the wall behind him. A few minutes later, Hiroko returns. She hands the picture back to Kanya with a bow, then speaks to Yashimoto. Neither of them betray any emotion. Hiroko kneels again beside them. Yashimoto nods at the photograph.
You're sure this was the one?
Kanya nods. There is no question.
And this assassination explains the increasing rage in the city. There are crowds gathering outside the factory, boat people. The police have driven them away, but they were coming with torches.
Kanya stifles her nervousness at the increasing frenzy. Everything is moving too fast. At some point, Akarat and Pracha will be unable to back off without losing face, and then everything will be lost.
The people are very angry, she says.
It is misplaced anger. She is not a military wind-up.
When Kanya tries to challenge him, he looks at her fiercely and she subsides.
Mishimoto knows nothing of military wind-ups, nothing. Such creatures are kept under strict control. They are used by our defense ministry only. I could never possess one.
He locks eyes with her.
Never.
And yet,
he continues to speak with Hiroko translating.
I know of the wind-up you describe. She had fulfilled her duty.
The wind-up girl's voice breaks off, even as the old man continues speaking. She straightens and her eyes flick to Yashimoto. He frowns at her break in decorum, says something to the wind-up. She ducks her head.
Hi.
Another pause. He nods at her to continue. She regains her composure, finishes translating.
She was destroyed, according to requirements, rather than repatriated.
The wind-up's dark eyes are on Kanya, steady, unblinking now, betraying nothing of the surprise she evinced a moment before. Kanya watches the girl and the old man, two alien people. And yet she apparently survived, she says finally.
I was not the manager at the time,
Yashimoto says.
I can only speak to what I know from our records.
Records lie, apparently.
You are correct. For this there is no excuse. I am ashamed of what others have done, but I have no knowledge of the thing.
Kanya leans forward.
If you cannot tell me how she survived, then please tell me how it is that this girl, capable of killing so many men in the space of heartbeats, could come into this country. You tell me she is not military, but, to be direct, I'm having difficulty believing that she is not. This is a gross breach of our country's agreements.
Unexpectedly, the man's eyes crinkle with a smile. He picks up his tea and sips, considering the question, but the mirth does not leave his eyes, even as he finishes his tea. This I can answer. Without warning, he flings his cup at Hiroko's face. Kanya starts to cry out. The wind-up girl's hand blurs. The teacup smacks into her palm. The girl gapes at the cup in her palm, as surprised apparently as Kanya. The Japanese man gathers the folds of his kimono around himself.
All new Japanese are fast.
You have mistaken the question to ask. How they use their innate qualities is a question of their training, not of their physical capabilities. Hiroko has been trained from birth to pace herself appropriately with decorum. He nods at her skin. She is manufactured to have a porcelain skin and reduced pores, but it means she is subject to overheating. A military wind-up will not overheat. It is built to expend considerable energy without impact. Poor Hiroko here would die if she exerted herself like that over any significant amount of time. But all wind-ups are potentially fast. It is in their genes. His tone becomes serious. It is surprising, though, that one has shaken off her training. Unwelcome news. New people serve us. It should not have happened.
So your Hiroko here could do the same thing. Kill 8 men, armed ones?
Hiroko jerks and looks at Yashimoto, dark eyes widening. He nods. Says something. His tone is gentle.
Hi.
She forgets to translate, then finds her words.
Yes, it is possible. Unlikely, but possible.
She continues.
But it would take an extraordinary stimulus to do so. New people value discipline, order, obedience. We have a saying in Japan. New people are more Japanese than the Japanese.
Yashimoto places a hand on Hiroko's shoulder. Circumstances would have to be extraordinary to make Hiroko into a killer. He smiles confidently.
This one you seek has fallen far from her proper place. You should destroy her before she can cause any more damage. We can provide assistance.
He pauses.
Hiroko here can help you.
Kanya tries not to recoil, but her face gives her away.
Captain Kanya, I do believe you're smiling.
Jaidee's pea is still with her, perched on the prow of the skiff as it cuts across the Chao Phraya's wide mouth on a stiff breeze. Spray blows through his form, leaving him unaffected, even though Kanya expects him to be drenched each time. She favors him with a smile, allowing her sense of well-being to reach out to him.
Today, I did something good.
Jaidee grins.
I listened to both ends of the conversation. Akarat and Narong were very impressed with you.
Kanya pauses.
You were with them as well?
He shrugs.
I can go almost anywhere, it seems.
Except on to your next life.
He shrugs again and smiles.
I still have work here. Harassing me, you mean?
But her words have no venom. Under the warm light of the setting sun, with the city opening before her and waves splashing against her boat's hull as they cut across the water, Kanya can only be grateful that the conversation went so well. Even as she was talking to Narong, they were issuing orders to their people to pull back. She heard the radio announcement go out. They would meet with the December 12 loyalists. The beginning of a stand-down. If the Japanese had not been so willing to take the blame for their rogue wind-up, it might have been different. But reparations were already being offered, and Pracha was exonerated by the copious documentation the Japanese offered. And for once, all things were turning out well. Kanya can't help but feel a measure of pride. Wearing the yoke of two patrons has finally paid off. She wonders if it is karma that places her, so that she could bridge the gap between General Pracha and Minister Akarat for the good of Krung Thep. Certainly no one else could have pierced the barriers of face and pride that the two men and their factions had erected. Jaidi is still grinning at her.
Imagine the things our country could accomplish if we were not always fighting one another.
In a burst of optimism, Kanya says,
maybe anything is possible.
Jaidi laughs. You still have a wind-up to catch.
Involuntarily, Kanya's eyes go to her own wind-up girl. Hiroko has folded her legs under her and gazes out at the city that is rapidly approaching, watching with curious eyes as they thread between clipper ships and sailing skiffs and Kingspring patrol boats. As if sensing Kanya's gaze, she turns. Their eyes lock. Kanya refuses to drop her gaze.
Why do you hate new people?
The wind-up asks.
Jaidi laughs. Can you lecture her about niche and nature?
Kanya looks away, glances behind her to the floating factories and drowned tomburi. The prang of Wat Arun stand tall against the blood-red sky. Again the question comes.
Why do you hate my kind?
Kanya eyes the woman. Will you be mulched when Yashimoto-sama returns to Japan? Hiroko lowers her gaze. Kanya feels obscurely embarrassed that she seems to have hurt the wind-up's feelings, then shakes off the guilt. It's just a wind-up. It apes the motions of humanity, but it is only a dangerous experiment that has been allowed to proceed too far. A wind-up. Stutter-stop motion and the telltale jerk of a genetically engineered beast. A smart one. And dangerous if pushed, apparently. Kanya watches the water as she guides her craft across the waves, but still she watches the wind-up out of the corner of her eye, viscerally aware that this wind-up contains the same wild speed of the other one. That all these wind-ups have the potential to become lethal. Hiroko speaks again.
We are not all like this one you hunt.
Kanya turns her gaze back on the wind-up. You are all unnatural, you are all grown in test tubes, you all go against niche, you all have no souls and have no karma. And now one of you has... She breaks off, overwhelmed at the enormity. Destroyed, our queen's protector. You are more than similar enough for me. Hiroko's eyes harden.
Then send me back to Mishimoto.
Kanya shakes her head.
No, you have your uses.
You are good proof, if nothing else, that all wind-ups are dangerous. And that the one we hunt is not a military creature. For that, you will be useful.
We are not all dangerous.
She insists again. Kanya shrugs.
Mr. Yashimoto says you will be of some help in finding our killer.
If that's true, then I have a use for you. If not,
I would just as soon compost you with the rest of the daily dung collection. Your master insists that you will be useful, though I can't think how. Hiroko looks away, across the water to her factories on the far side.
I think you hurt her feelings.
Jadi murmurs.
Are their feelings any more real than their souls?
Kanya leans against the tiller, angling the little skiff toward the docks.
There is still so much to be done.
Abruptly, Hiroko says,
She will seek a new patron.
Kanya turns, surprised.
What do you mean? She has lost her Japanese owner. She has now lost this man who ran the bar she worked for. She killed him.
Hiroko shrugs.
It is the same. She has lost her master. She must find a new one.
How do you know? Hiroko looks at her coldly.
It is in our genes. We seek to obey, to have others direct us. It is our necessity, as important as water for a fish. It is the water we swim in. Yashimoto-sama speaks correctly. We are more Japanese than even the Japanese. We must serve within a hierarchy. She must find a master.
What if this one is different, if this one doesn't?
She will. She has no choice. Just like you.
Hiroko's dark eyes sweep back to her.
Just so.
Is there a flicker of rage and despair in those eyes? Or does Kanya simply imagine it? Is it something Kanya assumes must be lurking deep within, an anthropomorphizing of a thing that is not and never will be human? A pretty puzzle. Kanya returns her attention to the water and their imminent arrival, checks the surrounding waves for other craft she will have to jostle with for slip space. She frowns.
I don't know those barges.
Hiroko looks up.
You keep such close watch on the waters?
Kanya shakes her head.
I used to work the docks when I was first inducted. Spot raids, checking imports. Good money.
She studies the barges. Those are built for heavy loads, more than just rice.
I haven't seen.
She trails off, her heart starting to pound as she watches the machines wallow forward, great dark beasts, implacable.
What is it?
Hiroko asks.
They aren't spring-driven.
Yes? Kanya pulls at her sail, letting the breezes of the river delta yank at the small boat, cutting away from the oncoming craft.
It's military.
They're all military.
Chapter 38. Anderson can barely breathe under the hood. The blackness is total, hot with his own breath and suppressed fear. No one explained why he was being hooded and marched out of the flat. Carlisle was awake by then, but when he tried to protest their treatment, one of the Panthers clipped his ear with a rifle butt, letting blood, and they'd both fallen silent, and allowed the hoods to be drawn over their heads. An hour later, they were kicked to their feet and herded down to some kind of transport that rumbled with exhaust fumes.
Army, Anderson guessed as he was shoved aboard. His broken finger hangs limply behind his back. If he flexes his hand, the pain becomes extreme. He practices a careful breathing under the hood, controlling his fears and speculations. The close, dusty fabric makes him cough, and when he coughs, his ribs send spikes of pain deep into his core. He breathes shallowly. Will they execute him as some kind of example? He hasn't heard Akarat's voice in some time. Hasn't heard anything. He wants to whisper to Carlisle to see if they are being kept in the same room, but doesn't feel like being clubbed again, if it turns out there's a guard in the room with him. When they were let down from the vehicle and dragged into a new building, he had been unsure if Carlyle was even there. And then they were in an elevator. He thinks they descended into some sort of bunker, but it is ghastly hot in the place where they kicked him down. The place is stifling hot. The hood's fabric itches. Of all the things he wishes he could scratch his nose, where sweat trickles and then damps the fabric, leaving it itching. He tries to move his face, tries to get the fabric away from his mouth and nose. If he could just get a breath of clean air. A door clicks. Footsteps. Anderson freezes. Muffled voices above him. Suddenly, hands grab him and yank him to his feet. He gasps as they jostle his broken ribs. The hands drag him along, guiding him through a series of turns and stops. A breeze kisses his arms, cooler, fresher air, some kind of air vents. He gets a whiff of the sea. Thai voices mutter around him. Footsteps, people moving. He has the sense that he is being led down a corridor. The steady arrival and recession of Thai voices. When he stumbles, his captors jerk him upright again and shove him onward. At last they stop. The air is fresher here. He feels the wind of circulation systems, hears the ratchet of treadles, and the high whine of flywheels, some kind of processing center. His captors push him to stand straight. He wonders if this is how they will execute him, if he will die without seeing daylight again. The wind-up girl, the goddamn wind-up girl. He remembers the way she flew from the balcony, plunging into darkness. It wasn't the look of a suicide. The more he thinks about it, the more he is convinced that the look on her face was one of supreme confidence. Did she really kill the Queen's protector? But if she were the killer, how could she have been so afraid? It doesn't make sense. And now everything is wrecked. Christ, his nose itches. He sneezes, sucks dusty hood air, and starts coughing again. He doubles over, coughing, ribs screaming. The hood is ripped off his face. Anderson blinks as light spears his eyes. He sucks gratefully at the luxury of fresh air. Slowly straightens. A large room full of men and women in army uniform, treadle computers, kink spring drums sitting in the room with them, even an LED wall screen with views of the city as if they were in one of Agrigen's own processing centers. And a view. He was wrong. He didn't go down, he went up, high above the city. Anderson reorients his confused perceptions. They're in a tower somewhere, an old expansion tower. Through the open windows, he can see across the city. The setting sun glazes the air and buildings a dull red. Carlyle is there too, looking dazed. "My goodness, you both smell terrible." Akarat, standing nearby, smiling with a certain sly humor. The Thais are said to have 13 kinds of smile. Anderson wonders what sort he is looking at now. Akarat says,
"We'll have to get you a shower."
Anderson starts to speak, but another fit of coughing overwhelms him. He sucks air, trying to get his lungs under control, but keeps coughing. The cuffs dig into his wrists as he convulses. His ribs are a mass of pain. Carlyle doesn't say anything at all. He has blood in his forehead. Anderson can't tell if he fought his captors or if he's been tortured.
"Get him a glass of water," Akarat says.
Anderson's guards push him against a wall, shove him down until he's seated. This time he narrowly avoids jostling his broken finger. Water arrives. A guard holds the cup to Anderson's lips, letting him drink. Cool water.
Anderson swallows, absurdly grateful. His coughing subsides. He makes himself look up at Akarat.
Thanks.
Yes, well, it seems we have a problem. Akarat says, your story checked out. Your wind-up is a rogue, after all. He squats down beside Anderson. We have all been victims of bad luck. They say in the military that a good battle plan can last as long as 5 minutes in real fighting. After that, it comes down to if the general is favored by fate and the spirits. Bad luck, this. We must all adjust. And now, of course, I have many new problems that I must adjust to as well. He nods at Carlyle. You both, of course, are angry at your treatment. He grimaces. I could offer my apologies, but I'm not sure that it would be enough. Anderson keeps his expression steady as he looks Akarat in the eye.
If you hurt us, you'll pay.
Agrigen will punish us. Akarat nods. Yes, that is a problem, but then Agrigen is always angry with us.
Untie me and we forget all this.
Trust you, you mean?
I worry that this is not wise.
Revolutions are a rough business. I don't hold a grudge.
Anderson grins, feral, willing the man to believe. No harm, no foul. We still want the same things. Nothing's been done that can't be undone.
Akarat cocks his head, thoughtful. Anderson wonders if he's about to get a knife in the ribs. Abruptly, Akarat smiles.
You are a hard man.
Anderson stifles a flutter of hope.
Just practical.
Our interests are still aligned. No one benefits with us dead.
This is still a small misunderstanding that we can undo.
Akarat considers, turns to one of the guards and requests a knife. Anderson holds his breath as it comes close. But then the blade is slicing between his wrists, setting him free. His arms flood with tingling blood. He works them slowly. They feel like blocks of wood. Needle pricks follow.
Christ!
It will take a little while for your circulation to recover. Be glad we were gentle with you. Akarat catches sight of the way Anderson cradles his injured hand. Smiles with embarrassment and apology. Calls for a doctor before going over to Carlyle.
What is this place?
Anderson asks.
An emergency command center. When it was determined that the White Shirts were involved, I moved our operations here for security.
Akarat nods at the Kingspring drums.
We have Megadont teams in the basement sending up power. And no one should know that we had this center equipped.
I didn't know you had something like this.
Akarat smiles.
We are partners, not lovers. I do not share all my secrets with anyone.
Have you caught the wind-up yet?
That's only a matter of time. Her likeness is now posted everywhere. The city will not permit her to live amongst us. It is one thing to bribe a few White Shirts, another to attack the palace.
Anderson thinks back to Emiko, to her huddled fear.
I still can't believe that a wind-up could do something like that.
Akarat glances up. It is confirmed by witnesses and by the Japanese who constructed her. The wind-up is a killer. We will find her and execute her in the old way, and we will be done with her. And the Japanese will be made to pay reparations unimaginable for their criminal carelessness. Abruptly, he smiles. On this, at least,